Accession number 10481, reel 2.
Chief Marshal Cross, reel 2.
At a later stage. I had some difficulty with the plan which we received from the shore on to how the squadron should fly into Scarland. It was proposed that we should go in dribs and drabs, in twos and threes, and after my experience in the centre of Norway, I thought this would be fatal, as we could easily be bombed without, when we had to land now in twos and threes, without being able to defend ourselves. And I had discussed how we should go in with my two flight commanders, and we wished to go in three formations of six. The first one would go in, and when it landed, the second one would stay overhead and guard them while they were being refueled and coming to readiness on the ground. Then the second formation would land, and they would be covered by the third six. And in that way, we would always be ready for action with at least two-thirds of the squadron. This conflicted with the instructions which I got from the shore, and I went to the commander flying, Commander Heath, and told him of my difficulty. He said, right, we will go and see the captain. Well, the captain did not like my dislike of the instructions which I had from the shore, but eventually, with persuasion from Heath, he agreed that my plan would be adopted, and he sent a signal to the shore to say that was how we were flying in. So we were ranged on deck in sixes, and I was the squadron commander, was the first to take off with a hurricane, which of course had never been done before from a carrier, and we didn't know, except for the Farnborough figures, whether the hurricane would do it or not. But in point of fact, with our variable pitch air screws and full power of the Merlin engine, they leapt off the deck without any difficulty at all. We reached Scarland. We were guided in by a swordfish with a navigator from the Glorious, and found Scarland, which was a strip, muddy strip on the edge of the fjord, covered with coconut matting and PS and summer felt tracking. Sort of wire netting over the top of the coconut matting. I landed first, and as I came to a stop, the wheels sank in, and the airplane tipped gently forward, and I bent about 2 inches of my air screw. I was furious because it was apparent that the airfield was unfit for landing on, and by this time all 18 aircraft of 46 Squadron were in the air. and with no diversion, as far as we knew, available. Because Bar du Fosse, the only other airfield, was some 70 or 80 miles away. The first person who approached me was some old reserve officer, and I let him have it and said the airfield was not fit for landing on. And such was the strain of the times up there, which we were to appreciate later with 24 hours of daylight and no respite from any reaction, the poor man burst into tears. However, the wing commander, who was I think you're going to have to switch off. The CO of the Air Force then appeared, and the next aircraft that came in after me landed successfully, and it was apparent that the CO thought that it was perhaps me, not the airfield, which was at fault. However, the third aircraft in dug in even more than I did and did a complete somersault on the runway and put it out of action. So there was nothing for it then. I climbed back into my aircraft and called the 46th Squadron aircraft still in the air and said, "You must go to find your way to Bar du Fosse. This airfield is now blocked." And it was a tribute to their training and ability that all the remaining aircraft with very inferior maps found their way to Bar du Fosse and landed successfully. The next day, my aeroplane having been having had the air screws straightened, I flew with the other pilot who landed successfully over to Bar du Fosse, and we operated from Bar du Fosse for the rest of the time we were in Norway. The attack on Narvik started the next day, and we patrolled Narvik alternatively with 263 Squadron Gladiators the whole of the time the assault was taking place, and no German air opposition was successful during the Narvik attack, which was captured in 48 hours. In the process, the odd German aircraft, Ju-88s or Hanker 111s, appeared, and we shot down several during this period of time. We were there at Bar du Fosse for about 2 weeks when the attack on France started, and we listened to the news of the German advance there, and it was a great disappointment to us when one day the commander of the RAF force told us that the government had decided to evacuate from North Norway, because at that time we had captured Narvik and we'd pushed the Germans right up back from Narvik up to the Swedish border, and in another 2 weeks the whole of North Norway would have been ours, but we understood perfectly well that the amount of shipping required to sustain an expedition at that distance up at Narvik was impossible with the major commitment now being in France. So we were to evacuate.
Could I just ask you about your first combat experience against the Luftwaffe? How did you find the Luftwaffe, the calibre of the Luftwaffe that you met up there?
Well, it was very light operations in the air, really, because it was out of range of German fighters. So we had the great advantage of only having bombers to attack. On the other hand, we had no radar, and it was all by a chance of picking the targets trying to pick the targets that Germans would attack to assist their ground forces, and patrolling that area to stop them. But it was a hit-and-miss business, and so the intensity of operations against the Germans were not intense. You understand?
Yes. Did you shoot down any yourself?
None. No. I was flying in the end about twice as much as anybody else, but I was extremely unlucky, and until the last morning of our stay at Bar du Fosse, I never met a German aeroplane in the air. Almost everybody else in the squadron did, and I was unlucky. On the last morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, it was light, I heard, lying in my tent, the readiness section go off. And I got up, put my overalls over my pajamas and went down to the ops tent and said, "What's going on?" And they said there'd been reports of German aircraft in the Harstadt area, and a readiness section had gone off to see what they could find. So I said, "I will take the next section, and will you call my number two?" It was a pilot called Pete Lefebvre, and Pete was called, and we taxied our two aircraft down to the end of the runway and then turned them round ready for takeoff, where to our astonishment we saw four Hankel 111s in a shallow dive about 3 miles, 4 miles, dead in line with the runway. And they were obviously on lining up for their bomb run. We turned round, saw these, and took off straight towards them at once. And they turned away from this head-on collision, which was going to take place, and did not bomb the airfield. They turned away and climbed away to the south. We went after them, and rather unwisely, instead of waiting time, I opened an attack and hit one of the Hankels, but I was hit at the same time by the fire from the rear guns, the other three Hankels, and the knocked the back out of my oil tank and shattered the windscreen, and that was that. I had been unable to do it. We'd been in such a hurry that I'd been unable to do up my straps when I got into the airplane, and I was leaning forward up against the windscreen when I was hit by the return fire from the Hankels, and in in retrospect, this was very fortunate, because when I landed, my rigger pointed out that right in the middle of the armor plate, behind my head, where my head would have been, was a neat round hole which had been drilled by an enemy armor-piercing bullet. So only the fact that I was leaning forward meant that it missed me.
So I interrupted you with you saying that the evacuation had been ordered.
Yes. Morrisman got it last. The CO of the Air Force detachment was Group Captain Maurice Moore, and he came to me and said, "We shall want you to cover the evacuation of the troops from the various fields by destroyers and then when the evacuation is complete, you can either destroy your aeroplanes or you can fly them up to the extreme north of Norway to a place called Laxel, which we understand there is a strip, but nobody was quite sure, and you can then dismantle your aeroplanes yourselves, and we will endeavour to get a tramp steamer there, and you can load them aboard that way." Well, the second alternative was quite impractical for pilots to completely dismantle their aeroplanes in the first place. And anyway, there was no guarantee that having done that, there was going to be a ship which we could load them onto. So I declined that course straight away, as I also did proposal to burn the aeroplanes as the last thing at Bardufoss, because we thought that the aeroplanes would be needed at home anyway, and we'd lost a few in battle by this time. In fact, we'd lost 8 altogether, and we were determined that we should try and get them home. And I said to Maurice Moore, "We hear that the Glorious is back offshore. Couldn't we make an attempt to land on the Glorious?" And he said, "But the Farnborough figures say it's impossible." I said, "But my pilots don't believe that it is impossible. They believe that they could do it. And I believe we could do it. And we will put a sandbag in the last bay of the thing to keep the tail down, which means we can use full brakes, and we believe we can land on the Glorious of this." So he said, "Well, if you think you can, I'm quite prepared for you to have a try." And I said, "I would like to go out to the Glorious." This was the night before, to tell them that we're going to try. And he said, I will arrange that." And a walrus, amphibian, came in that day with an Air Force officer called Carey aboard it, and we went off to the Glorious and said, could we do it? And Commander Heath was no longer there, and but his Lieutenant Commander Parkin, his number two, said, "That's fine, we'll be all ready for you." And the Glorious was in company with the Ark Royal, which was a modern carrier and had a much longer deck than the Glorious. But they hadn't got the big lifts which the Glorious had, and therefore couldn't lower our aeroplanes into the hangars in the Ark Royal, as the fleet aircraft did, because the fleet aircraft, of course, all had folding wings, and we didn't. But I landed on the Ark Royal, and they said, well, if you can't get on the Glorious, have a try here. We've got another 100 feet of deck, and we'll store your aeroplanes on deck if necessary. Or we'll chop the wings off and save the fuselages. And then I went back, we flew back to Bar de Fosse for the last day's operations, which I've already told you started with my own thing at 3 o'clock in the morning. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we'd been flying hard all day, but there was very little interference with the evacuation by the Luftwaffe. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I sent my most experienced flight commander, Flight Lieutenant Jemson, with two of his pilots, to go out to the Glorious. To see if the Hurricane in fact could land on, because I thought if we all went together at 10, it would be a great embarrassment to the Glorious and possibly to the Ark Royal if we were all flying around running out of petrol and having to land. And I thought it would be a good idea to send three, so that if they couldn't land, they could signal back to us, and we'd have to reconsider the whole position. Well, they went, a swordfish appeared overhead at Bar de Fosse, and Jameson and his two, Sergeant Taylor and Bunter, I think it was, went off to the Glorious with instructions to send us a signal saying okay or not okay. And we never got that. We never got any signal at all. And so, at the end of the day, or rather the beginning of the next morning, because it was 24 hours exactly from the time that I had taken off that morning, that I took off with the remainder of the squadron, 7 aircraft, to fly out to the Glorious, 3 o'clock on the morning, in the morning. So we had been flying, in fact, for 24 hours. Solid. And we flew out to the ship, and it was a very welcoming sight when we saw the blinking light which these carriers always carried on the horizon, and then it was time to try. We didn't know whether Jameson and his two pilots had been successful or not, and I did the first landing, and in point of fact it turned out to be a relatively simple operation. The Hurricane, my Hurricane, stopped little over two-thirds up the deck, and I was standing on the brakes pretty hard all the time, and all seven came on successfully. So in fact we'd saved the 10 remaining aeroplanes in the squadron. Well, we went to down below for some hot cocoa, and then the fact that we had no sleep for 24 hours eventually caught up with us. Up to that time, we were doing an operation which nobody had done before. There was no sleep for 24 hours, but nobody felt the least bit fatigued when they were doing this operation, this landing on the Glorious. But once it was over, and the actually, we were all exhausted, and we all fell into the bunks, which were allocated to us. And And nobody woke up, really, until mid-afternoon the next day, which was June the 8th. I woke up at about 3:30 and I went along to the wardroom and was having sitting in the wardroom where tea was being served and having a cup of tea when the action stations was sounded on the ship's tannoy. I mentioned that we had been in the ship for 10 days before, and we'd had many practice alarms in that period, and I assumed this was another practice. And I knew that I would be... We had no action stations allotted to us, but we had abandoned ship stations allotted to us from our previous passage, and I remembered that it meant a lot of standing about in these practices. And I went along to my cabin and put on my Irving jacket, my padded Irving jacket, and for some unknown reason I put the squadron funds amounting to £200 or £300 in an envelope in my inner pocket. I don't know why I did that, but I did. And then I went up to my action station, which was on the quarter deck, right at the extreme stern of the ship. When I got there, I saw on the horizon two patches of smoke. And as I looked at them, I saw flashes. And within a few seconds, three plumes of water arrived in the just about 10 yards off where we were standing. It was, considering that the Germans were virtually out of sight, all you could see was the smoke. It was a remarkable first salvo. I then thought that perhaps I ought to report to the bridge as the CO of the squadron and see whether there are any instructions for me. And so I went up the starboard gangway onto the on the starboard side of the ship onto the flight deck, and as I stepped onto the deck, a second salvo hit the ship, demolishing the gangway I just